Welcome back to the second episode of the long-term memory radio documentary, Not So Fundamental Rights, Security Certificates and Secret Trials in Canada. Under a security certificate, the Canadian government can arrest and imprison refugees and permanent residents based on a suspicion that they might be a threat to national security. There are currently five Muslim men who have been detained for years without charge, chance for bail, or even access to the supposed evidence against them. Their names are Mohammed Majoub, Mahmoud Jabala, Hassan Amri, Mohammed Harkat, and Adil Sharkawi. If the court determines that it is a possibility that they might be a threat, they will be deported to their countries of origin without a chance to appeal. Last week, we introduced the security certificate process and discussed the horrible injustices of this legislation for the detainees, their families, and targeted communities in Canada. This week, we will investigate how the use of secret trials, indefinite detention, and deportation to torture is legitimized in the name of national security and the war on terror. Security certificate legislation has existed in its current form since the early 1990s. However, secret trials have been taking place in Canada for much longer. Matthew Behrens, an active member of the Campaign to Stop Secret Trials, talks about what groups have historically been targeted. He also tells us about security certificate legislation and its long-term implications for civil liberties, and he explains how the campaign is working to bring attention to these issues.
Ever since the founding of the country of Canada, on top of the detention of hundreds of thousands of First Nations peoples, Canada has always relied, either in times of crisis or in just regular so-called times, on the use of secret evidence to target specific groups and populations and intern them. During the First World War, Ukrainians were interned. During the 1920s and 30s, labor activists, many of whom were first-generation immigrants, were targeted, and many of them in the thousands were deported because they were deemed a security threat because they were standing up for their rights. During the Second World War, Japanese Canadians, among others, were interned, Italian Canadians, German Canadians. And more recently, we're seeing, if we bring it up to the present, there's been a fairly extensive campaign directed at the Arabic Middle Eastern Muslim communities in Canada. Essentially, since the end of the Cold War, those communities have been the enemy du jour for CSIS and the RCMP. I think if you actually look at CSIS's own history and their own oversight committee, the Security Intelligence Review Committee, towards the end of the Cold War, they were actually asking questions about what is our mandate, what is our purpose. And when the Berlin Wall fell and when the Soviet Union collapsed, CSIS, along with most Western spy agencies, went into a crisis because their whole modus operandi had been catching Soviet spies, playing espionage games. And literally, instead of looking around at the world as it was, they had to find a new enemy to justify their existence. And so what they started to do was say, well, maybe economic sabotage is something we should go after. Maybe terrorism is something we can go after. But if we're going to go after terrorism, we have to find certain individuals and groups which we can label as terrorists. Around that time, of course, there was the Gulf War I, the first slaughter in Iraq that was led by the United States in 1991. And to do that, there had to be a great deal of demonization of the communities that we were going to be bombing. It happened, of course, that it was Iraq. And so here in Canada, CSIS stepped up its harassment and its interrogation of people within the Arabic community. And that has carried on ever since, which is not to say that this didn't exist even before Gulf War I. If you look historically, with the exception of the 100 years of the 20th century when communism was the big enemy, Islam has always been viewed as threatening to the Christian world for thousands of years. When CSIS was created in 1984, after all the scandals involving the RCMP, they had the power to issue these security certificates to basically say, we're of the opinion that a certain individual is inadmissible to Canada based on security concerns. And those used to be handled by the Security Intelligence Review Committee. The individual was not detained for extensive periods of time. There was still secret evidence that was used, but they also had an independent counsel who would take the questions of a defense attorney behind closed doors and ask them. So the process was not perfect, but it was certainly a lot more fair, if you can use that term, than it is now. And what they were finding is a number of the people who were being deemed threats were not, and they were being cleared. And I think the impetus for the detention part of the security certificate came in the immigration changes that were made in the early 1990s, so that when you actually arrest someone and detain them and then bring that case to the federal court, there's immediately this air of, well, if they're in detention, they must be a threat, as opposed to beforehand when these folks were walking the street. So the changes were needed for CSIS so that they could have a much easier time of it, because CSIS historically and to this day is a very sloppy organization. They don't dot their I's and cross their T's. They don't do their homework. They know little or nothing about the culture, the religion of individuals and groups that they're investigating. So if you can rely on secret evidence and the person is in prison, you've already done a great deal of the work you need to demonize someone and turn them into a threat. I think what's really scary is the fact that increasingly in Canada we're criminalizing refugees. We're basically punishing people who for whatever reason have come to Canada to escape persecution in their homelands, to escape poverty, and we throw them in prison if they haven't filled out the right form, if they haven't followed the same process, perhaps they don't speak English. And currently, on average, we have between 600 and 700 refugee claimants who are detained for no reason. They don't pose a threat to Canada or to Canadians, and yet they are detained. So increasingly, we're saying, if you want to come to this country, you know, unless you look like a lily-white European, chances are you're going to be detained and criminalized. Another problem is the fact that our reliance on secrecy means we're starting to see that more and more in the refugee process and in things like the Citizenship Act, which the government keeps introducing, that would allow the Minister of Immigration or someone that minister delegates to strip someone of their citizenship rights without recourse, without appeal, based on secret evidence. So it's the thin edge of the wedge in many respects. And what they've been doing is they're building up 10 years worth of case law and precedents so that they continue to apply the hammer to each new group that they're going to target. The campaign came together by accident. To our own shame, we didn't know that this stuff was going on in Canada, and only found out about it with the arrest of Mahmoud Jabala, his second arrest in 2001 in the summer, after he had already been cleared in 1999 of the allegations in a security certificate, and he had been released. And it was only by going to court, trying to reach out to the family, the Jabala family, and then some of the other families that were affected, that the campaign began to grow. But we were literally fishing in the dark when we started this. And so our very first public protest was a walk for Canada's disappeared. And the media kept saying, well, who are these people? And we said, that's our question too. We don't know how many people were detained after September the 11th. We still don't know that. And that's something that we should really push the government on, is to say, who made the decision to just pull people off of airplanes that landed in Canada and throw them in solitary confinement for 3 months and then release them with no compensation, no apology, no explanation? You come from the Middle East, therefore you're suspect. So as we began to do this, those people and communities that were being targeted began to realize that there were allies outside of the community. And when we first started this, there were only two cases that we were aware of at the time, Mr. Majoub and Mr. Jabala. Then Hassan Almri was picked up, and Mohammed Harkat, and then Mr. Sherkawi as well. So we've been using a wide range of tactics, long distance walks, vigils, education, nonviolent civil disobedience, court support, just trying to, in as many ways as possible, reach out and say, you can't condemn someone on secret evidence. And to agree with those who are imprisoned, to say, if you've got something on them, charge them. Give them a fair and open trial and provide the case against them in the same way that you would do if someone went and murdered 15 people in a public space. They would be given the right to full disclosure. And these guys haven't committed a single act. They're just alleged to be associated, possibly, with certain groups whose activities would make them inadmissible to Canada. And when they go through the court process, it's the lowest standard of proof of any court in Canada. It's reasonable grounds to believe that something might be possible. A lot of people in our campaign are white, and so CSIS doesn't bother us. They bother those individuals who are not white and who are Muslim. I was recently at a wedding at a mosque, and I was amazed still at the number of people who came up and said, CSIS hangs out on Friday nights across the street. They come to my door. They want me to talk with them. They want me to spy for them. But I think we have had an effect with respect to the fact that there's not been a security certificate issued since the one in May of 2003 against Adil Sharkawi. When we went to CSIS's national headquarters on October the 31st, Halloween of 2003, to trick-or-treat for secret evidence, the day before, CSIS issued a special report saying we don't discriminate against Muslims. So when a small group of people can put CSIS in the position where they have to feel that they have to justify themselves and say, oh no, we don't go after Muslims, and they also put on their website, well, this is how a security certificate works, and that fall as well, the head of CSIS at the time, Ward Elcock, began his testimony before a subcommittee of the House of Commons by stating, let's be very clear, these things are not secret trials, and it seems to me he wouldn't have said that without being prompted unless he was getting a lot of mail, which he is, to say that these are secret trials and they've got to be stopped. There's a lot of directions that we could take it in, and we take our direction from the families and from the detainees themselves, and we speak very clearly and say, this is what we're doing, what do you think, and they come up with ideas themselves. I think we still need to do a lot of education, because people don't know this is taking place. Around the issue of secret trials, we also have to do a lot of education around Islamophobia, because we are incredibly Islamophobic as a culture, and we need to educate the media, we need to educate teachers about that, and we also need to educate people about the war on terror and what that is and what it means, and look at all the myths behind it and all the lies that it is based on. There was recently a report in the United States that said 5,000 individuals from these targeted communities had been arrested in relationship to terrorism post-September the 11th, and they have a grand total of zero jury convictions of these individuals. So if you're basing all of these arrests, detentions, surveillance, hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars in Homeland Security, and you're throwing people behind bars and disrupting communities, and you can't produce a single conviction, then you have to start asking questions. What is this really based upon? And it's the same thing here in Canada. If you had an opportunity to charge them and provide evidence, you would do that. But they don't. And that's why they're pursuing this secrecy thing. They're trying to justify their budget. They're trying to play big league ball with the Americans and with the British and with the Israelis. But there's really, you know, there's nothing there. And CSIS is literally has created a phantom for itself to fight. What time is it? If you want to get together, then you better find a better fit. The first world's first. What's new? Not much. Don't touch.
It's a world full of cops. Since the end of the Cold War, the justification for funding intelligence agencies around the world has switched from communism to terrorism, but their methods and assumptions remain the same. Now a new group of people are the primary target for spying, threats, interrogations, and imprisonment for supposedly being a danger to freedom and democracy. Ahmed Jabala is the son of Mahmoud Jabala, one of the men detained in Toronto. He tells the story of how CSIS repeatedly interrogated his father and arrested him when he wouldn't agree to spy on members of his community. Ahmed was 13 when his father was first arrested. In the parking lots, cops that are cool and cops that are hot in lots. It's a world full of cops.
There were three different times when my dad was interrogated at our house. All three was by CSIS, and the first time they came to our house late in the evening. They told him who they were, and they told him that they just wanted to speak to him. So my dad advised them that he would like to go to a coffee time or Tim Hortons to speak there. rather than speak at our house, because we only had a two-bedroom apartment, and we were five kids at the time, and obviously we needed to go to sleep and so on. So they insisted that it should take place at our house. My dad allowed them into the house, and they spent most of the night at our house. Like, the first time he came to our house, he was very friendly. He spoke to my dad about, you know, his life story, and he asked my dad questions about his life story. And I remember how the agent was telling my dad about his father, how great of a person he was, and how he served Canada and so on. So basically, that first meeting was all, you could call it a friendly talk, in which they were just exchanging background information. And then after some time passed, they came again for a second visit. And this time the agent came with another agent. They sat down with my dad. I think it was the night of the 1998 U.S. embassy bombings in Kenya, Tanzania. The same night the bombings happened, that's when they came to our house. And by that time, nothing was on the newspaper yet or anything like that. So the agents came to our house and they informed my dad about the bombings, and they showed him pictures of people who are suspects and who will be arrested shortly. My dad listened to them patiently, and then they kept showing him pictures and asking if he knew this person, knew that person, and things like that. The whole night was just basically asking him information, asking him if he's where he's been, and if he's been to Afghanistan, if he met this person or that person. But that's something he told them, that I haven't met any of these people, nor have I spoken to any of them. And then they came for the final time. And this time, there was one agent and one interpreter. It was also late. And this was, I think, the longest time they stayed at our house, and in which the interpreter got very tired and he went to sleep. This time, when they came, my mom was very shaky about what's going on. She knew something was wrong. So she advised me to put a tape recorder in the hallway and record their conversation, but without their knowledge, obviously. So I did what my mom told me. I took a tape recorder, placed it in the hallway, and put in a tape and recorded their conversation. And then since the interpreter was asleep, I had to do the duty of interpreting whatever the agent was saying to my dad, because my dad had very broken English. So the ending of the interrogation was basically as follows, that when the agent told my dad that if you wouldn't cooperate with us and do what we tell you to do in terms of spying on the community or giving us information about individuals who come to the mosque, etc., we will refuse your immigration status and we will arrest you and send you back to your homeland. And I, upon hearing this and translating it to my dad, I started to fall to cry, because I know what we had to go through in the past, and I was just afraid that I might have to go through it again. So my dad, he told him straight up, he goes, I'm not going to sell my religion for such a job, and I'll tell you from now that I'm not going to cooperate. When the agent, when he became very disrespectful, my dad asked him to leave. And upon leaving, he told my dad, I will give you a short time to think about it and reply to me. And my dad again told him straight up forward that I'm not cooperating and I'm not doing anything that you have asked me to do. Shortly after, my dad was arrested, but my dad was kind of expecting it, because it wasn't the first time he has experienced that. When we were back in Egypt, he had to go through the same thing. And that's one of the reasons we left Egypt, because they would come to our house, or arrest him, and then upon releasing him, they would ask him to work for them and spy for them on the community and things like that. And they will give him money, and they will give him houses and cars and make his life happy and so on. And he refused that, because he knows that this is wrong in our religion. So this is the kind of things we had to go through back home. And when we came to this country, we came here wanting a peaceful and a happy life. But it was very, very shocking and upsetting to find out that the same things we had to go through back home, we have to go through here in this country too. CSIS had a big role in my dad's arrest, in terms of accusing him of being a terrorist, accusing him of being linked to a group called Al-Jihad and so on. But now I understand why my dad was arrested, because he did not do what they told him to do. And I thought in this country you had the freedom to do as you like. Now, the way I see it as, if you don't do as they say, you will suffer the consequences, which is absolutely not democracy. And on top of that, What we found out was that none of the conversations in our house was recorded by the agent. And he would go home, since it was so late, he would go to sleep, and then when he would wake up in the morning, he would write hundreds of pages of report explaining how my dad is a threat to this country. Now, a couple of hours, or especially after going to sleep after an interview, I would forget half of the things I talked about in the interview. How could he write a big report about how dangerous my dad is and so on by not even recording the conversation and by spending most of the conversation joking and talking about his life story and asking my dad about his life story? That doesn't make sense to me. And then on top of that, when we were in court in 1999 the first time around, the agent was forced by the court to come to court to testify, but it was a closed hearing. And our lawyer was very clever. He asked him about what happened in the interviews and so on. But the agent, thinking that they only have his word, he said whatever he wanted to say. But then he was surprised to see a tape played of that last conversation that he had at our house. And if you see his face in that court hearing, you can compare it to as red as a tomato. I would like people to see the truth about what's really going on in this country, and to do something about it, because to tell you the truth, now, today, it's my dad. Tomorrow, it's going to be somebody else's turn. And it's going to keep happening unless we put an end to it. Because we're supposed to be, a democratic country. We're supposed to have equal rights for all. We're a multicultural country where people from all over the world react together and see each other every day, but welcome each other with open hearts. And this cannot continue if we have to go through such things as what CSIS puts us through. To us all, I'm pretty sure everyone agrees to me. Everyone thinks spying is bad. Everyone deserves their own privacy. But to see CSIS promote that kind of values, they're not being a role model to their citizens. They should be role models for us. But since they're lacking their job, we should do our best to be role models for them by telling them what they're doing is wrong, standing up for what's right, and for refusing to fall in their traps. It's not about my dad, as I said. It's not about any of the other five that are in there right now. They're in there temporarily, but it's about the rest of the society, the rest of our nation. It's going to be everyone's turn is going to come if we don't put an end to this.